His home now is Singapore, and in particular a certain hospital in Singapore.
An ailing president is in Singapore. It's Wednesday, July 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us too online at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, documenting Myanmar's displaced persons, tracing Australia's turbulent past, China strives to improve its English, creative coding, and biodegradable microbeads. Hear it all right now as we get started with VOA Asia. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is seeking medical help in Asia. Some in his African nation now consider him a resident of Singapore, as he has spent considerable time in a hospital there. The controversial Mugabe is 93 years old. He's been president of Zimbabwe for 30 years and was prime minister for another seven. Mugabe has been derided as a dictator responsible for economic mismanagement and widespread corruption, racial discrimination, human rights abuses, suppression of political critics, and crimes against humanity. Several nations have closed embassies in Zimbabwe in protest of Mugabe's policies, but he has had success reaching out to countries like China, although most of the signed multi-billion-dollar projects with Beijing have now been put on hold. Mugabe is on his third trip to Singapore since January for unscheduled medical treatment. The travel has prompted serious concern about the health of Africa's oldest leader, as we hear more about this long and complicated relationship with Asia from Sebastian Mofu in Harare.
Rumors have abounded in Zimbabwe since late Friday when President Robert Mugabe left for Singapore, where he has previously sought treatment for eye problems. State media reported Sunday that the president is in Singapore now for, quote, a routine medical checkup, unquote. Regis Chikore, the principal director in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information, told VOA that reports on social media suggesting the president's condition is more serious are, quote, rubbish, unquote. A number of events, including the weekly cabinet meeting held every Tuesday, have been postponed for an unspecified, quote, number of days, said officials in the state media. The opposition says it is time for Mugabe, who has presided over Zimbabwe since independence in 1980, to step down. Jacob Mafume is the spokesman for the People's Democratic Party, PDP, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti.
He is now a visitor to Zimbabwe. His home now is Singapore, and in particular a certain hospital in Singapore. He is an inpatient who should by all means be in a hospital. And the tragedy is that he should be coming out of the hospital into an old people's home, not state house. There is nothing magical about the office of the president that makes you not retire within the normal time. All other public service posts, people retire at 65.
In Zimbabwe, there is no upper age limit for the president. Mugabe celebrated his 93rd birthday this year and announced plans to seek another term in the 2018 elections. When he returned from a trip to Singapore in late February, Mugabe had this to say to those who wished he were dead or retired.
Vamwana kutakira, the president is going to die.
Some say the president is going to die. Some wrote in the media that the president is sick, he has gone to Malaysia or Singapore, so he is on his way dying. He then continued in Shona saying, some people start making movements in anticipation of my death. I'm not going to die. Shame. Before he was in Singapore, Mugabe traveled to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for the semi-annual African Union Heads of State Summit and then to Swaziland. Mugabe also visited Dubai, China, Mexico, South Africa, Ghana, Mauritius, and Mali this year. The opposition says the high cost of foreign travel has become an issue for Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government. Official documents released by the Treasury show the president spent $50 million on foreign travel last year against a budget of $23 million. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Stay up to date with VOA Asia as we monitor the health of Zimbabwe's aging president while he seeks treatment in Asia. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. China controls information about ailing Nobel Prize laureate. South Korea disputes North's claim of long-range missile test. U.S. shoots down missile in intercept test over Pacific. China says, quote, China responsibility theory on North Korea has to stop. Floods, landslides in northeastern India claim more lives. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The plight of displaced communities in Myanmar's Western Rakhine State and the impact of the displacement on children has led to calls in a new film to boost education as a vital step to end divisions between Buddhist and Muslim communities. The documentary film Sitwe was released this month in Thailand after it was banned by Myanmar censors at its original debut at a human rights film festival in Yangon. Directed by American filmmaker Gene Halasi, the film focuses on challenges faced by two 16-year-old teenagers, a Buddhist boy and a Muslim girl, who live in internally displaced camps in Rakhine State. Both their homes were torched during intercommunal violence in 2012, and that violence led to over 100,000 people forced into camps where many, especially from the Muslim community, remain today. Muslims are prevented from returning to their former homes in Sitwe. Halasi says the film hopes to end tensions that remain between the Buddhist and Muslim communities.
The film was intended to try to create a small window of discourse among youth who are living in this conflict area. And we went out of our way to make sure that we were also including Buddhist youth in this, that it wasn't just Rohingya Muslims, but because Buddhist kids have also been affected.
The violence of 2012 devastated local communities, leading 140,000 to flee their homes into displacement camps. Others fled by boat to other parts of Southeast Asia seeking refuge. The Muslim Rohingya people remain in government-controlled camps. They are not permitted to leave, even for education, and rely on informal schools within the camps. Last year, further bloodshed erupted after 9 police officers were killed in Rakhine State by a group of Rohingya militants. Thousands of Rohingya fled to neighboring Bangladesh. The film was supported by the Myanmar-based non-governmental organization Smile Education and Development Foundation, whose executive director, Myo Win, says he hopes to draw the international community's attention to the plight of education in Rakhine State. Progress toward community reconciliation has been slow, if at all. Sai Kwa Kyung, the cameraman for the project, says both sides living in the camps face economic and social hardships. The United Nations has been highly critical of the camps' conditions, especially for the Rohingya community. New York-based Human Rights Watch is pessimistic over the human rights situation in Rakhine State, with Deputy Asia Director Phil Robertson calling the situation bleak. Cameraman Sai Kwa sees divisions sown by vitriol from both communities.
Dark. It's in the dark. I don't see hope. It's coming. You have to solve a lot of problems in there. Even the government. They have to. Both sides is what we call brainwashed. Both sides of community.
Later this month, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, Yong Hee Lee, is to make an official visit to Myanmar, including Rakhine State. The UN's Human Rights Council has proposed a fact-finding mission on rights in Myanmar, a move opposed by the central government of Myanmar. Our thanks to Ron Corbin in Bangkok for contributing to this story. Happening now in Asia, China's foreign ministry brushed aside U.S. and German offers to treat Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo overseas and fulfill his dying wish that he and his wife be allowed to go abroad. State media Tuesday stated China will not yield to Western pressure and attempts to politicize Liu's cancer treatment. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad that you're spending part of your day with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening. Researchers in Australia have created what they say is the most detailed map ever to record the massacres of Indigenous Australians by European settlers. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports the document took 4 years to produce, and it followed exhaustive scrutiny of court records, newspaper articles, and diaries.
The map, which is available online, documents more than 150 locations of massacres of Australia's original inhabitants following the arrival of British colonists in 1788. The research includes information about the number of people killed at each site, the type of weapons used, and who was responsible. The deaths were part of the frontier wars between Indigenous Australians and European settlers that lasted for many decades and claimed thousands of lives. Historian Lyndall Ryan, a professor at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales State, hopes the work will lead to the sites being recognised with official memorials or monuments.
This could be the beginning, now that we know where the sites are, certainly up the east coast of New South Wales, or a little bit inland. I think it would be possible, for example, along the Murray River, to have some identified sites. This is a battle site. However, we still haven't reached the point where we will stop desecrating these sites. We've got a long way to go to accept the frontier war.
Ryan says the map is a preliminary study and researchers hope to add more sites from other parts of Australia over time. The document was created by studying various accounts of each battle using newspapers, diaries from settlers and court records. The study defines a massacre as the indiscriminate killing of six or more unarmed or undefended people. Many Indigenous Australians believe that Australia was invaded by the British, who arrived in the late 18th century to establish a penal colony. Aboriginal campaigners argue that colonisation has robbed them not only of their land, but is also responsible for social marginalisation and current high rates of poverty and ill health. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. South Korea's intelligence agency cast doubt on North Korea's boasts it carried out a test launch of its first intercontinental ballistic missile. A South Korean lawmaker told reporters the National Intelligence Service has not been able to confirm that Pyongyang has developed the technology to build an ICBM. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Walk around Chinese cities these days and you'll often notice English translations on public signs. And quite often, there's an embarrassing problem that's hard to ignore. Many of the translations are incorrect, sometimes laughable. For example, please wait behind the line becomes please wait outside rice flour noodle. But for foreigners who have long cherished these cute discoveries in China, the so-called Chinglish fun may soon be over. Chinese authorities last month released a national standard for using English on public signs. The standard offers more than 3,500 standard English translations of Chinese phrases and terms for business sectors such as transportation, tourism, and dining. VOA Asia intern Harry Chen spoke via Skype with Paul Mooney, a China correspondent for Western news media outlets who was based in Beijing for nearly two decades, and asked him why the Chinese authorities decided to put out a national standard of English translations.
They feel it's embarrassing to have these mistakes, and some of them are quite funny, and some of them, you know, can be quite bad. Like, you know, one of the signs that's often mentioned is the Park of Ethnic Minorities, which is translated in a sign as racist park. Now, that sounds really bad. And there are quite a few terms in Chinese that can have a sexual meaning and a non-sexual meaning. And when it's translated in the sexual meaning, when it's not appropriate, then it's quite funny. So I think the Communist Party is trying to improve China's image by improving the signs. Because, you know, if you look online, you go to, there are blogs about this, it's on YouTube, it's all over the internet, you know, foreigners taking pictures of these signs. And I think they're embarrassed by that.
In terms of adding signs, a lot of people are talking about, you know, so many businesses are adding English translation for the sake of adding it. What do you think of this view for them to just do it?
You know, English has a certain kind of magic about it among Chinese people. And so, you know, as people will throw an English word or two into their sentences when they're speaking Chinese, it's kind of fashionable. And so a lot of shops and stores and people want to put signs in English. So it's just this kind of fascination with the English language, I think, that makes people want to do this, even when there's no need to do it.
Over the years, you know, we were talking about an increasing number of signs with English translations, and you've seen so many of them produced to so much laughter. So why do you think the government has waited so long to finally do it?
As you mentioned, they did try in the run-up to the Olympics. But, you know, in China, a lot of times they have campaigns like this, and, you know, like not smoking in public places. They announced that three or four times and people are still smoking in public places. I think it's because they don't follow through. They start out with a lot of enthusiasm, but the government never really kind of it's not consistent. It doesn't push ahead and make sure that they follow through in a lot of these campaigns. But the bigger problem might be in a campaign to let people know that it exists, especially if we're talking about safety issues, road signs, things like that. That's going to be needed all over the country, and it's important because you want to protect people, but you have to let people know. Just like I said with the official translation of dishes for Chinese restaurants, I don't think restaurants were even aware that it existed. I didn't know it existed until the draft of the book was corrected in several places, you know, so they wanted to have standard names. But, you know, unless you let people know, they're not going to pick up on these things. So you just can't put up a website and then expect people to find it.
How difficult do you think it will be to enforce this standard?
I think it's going to be very difficult. You know, China is a big country. It's a huge population. And as I said, the government doesn't have a good record in following through on campaigns like this. I can't tell you how many times I reported on these things only to find it announced two or three years later as if it's a brand new program. So unless somebody behind it is going to really kind of push it forward, I don't imagine it's going to be very successful.
Do you believe this is a priority to the government?
No, you know, I think that some of the signs are charming, and I think the government's got the wrong idea. I don't think that foreigners laugh at China because of these signs. I think they find it, you know, charming. I think they find it cute. And so I don't think anyone would have kind of bad feelings about China because of these signs. It's something that you chuckle about and you share a photo. I don't think it hurts China's image at all. No, and I think there are other things that need to be done in terms of cleaning up pollution and improving hygiene and things like that that are a higher priority. But we don't always hear things about campaigns to do that.
Paul Mooney, a former China correspondent and now a freelance journalist, speaking with VOA Asian intern Harry Chen. Chinese state media have announced that the authorities will officially start the implementation of the standard in December. Developing at this hour in Asia, the former chief executive officer of a failed Bitcoin exchange pleaded not guilty to charges he stole hundreds of millions of dollars worth of the virtual currency. French-born Mark Karpeles appeared Tuesday in Tokyo District Court. Prosecutors accused the 32-year-old of moving millions of Bitcoins into his personal account. Bank on VOA Asia Facebook for the latest stories and features. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a common assumption is that writing computer code is highly technical skill for people who are good at math and logic. There's another quality in the tech world that's just as important, creativity. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on a game that teaches children the creative side of coding.
Dylan and Megan Dodge may look like they're just playing a computer game, but they actually are making music by creating simple computer code.
It's an analytical skill that kids are going to need to have as they grow up in this new era.
But writing code should be more than just an analytical skill, say the developers of this game called Osmo Coding Jam.
We wanted to explore the creative side of coding that I think is often not as explored.
So we kind of actually look to Lego also as a sort of just great example of things that kids like to build with. And so in this case, instead of building a house or, you know, a castle, they're building lines of code.
Pretty much like it says, it kind of tells you.
A big part of the way that technology is changing and becoming more engaging is because I think we're adding that artistic piece to it, right? That it's not just code and pressing buttons, but the experience of it. And you can't successfully do that, in my opinion, without having a connection to that artistic piece.
Developers say coding should be seen as a tool for people to use to create whatever they want. Code was used to create this game, and children use these coding tiles to create music.
I think the coolest part is that we're teaching kids how to be creative with code. And that's a really important thing that kids should get comfortable with.
Especially since more children are learning to code. Developers see more parents who consider coding a second language that children need to succeed in the future.
I think in every aspect of at least the careers I see going forward, you're going to have to understand at some point the concept of coding.
We don't want to create just workers, we want to create creators.
And unlocking the creative side of the brain, these developers say, is just as important as learning the language of coding. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
Microplastics are pieces of plastic under 5 millimeters in size. They're everywhere. They make up part of the estimated tens of millions of tons of plastic that gets washed into the ocean every year. And that could be hurting fish that eat plastic and humans when we eat the fish. Fortunately, as VOA's Kevin Enix reports, help may be on the way.
All of these products contain microbeads. Tiny bits of plastic that act as exfoliants, mildly abrasive beads that help clean skin or teeth. The problem is that all these tiny bits of plastic go right into the ocean.
If you were washing yourself once a day with a microbead-containing formulation to give you that nice smooth glow that you get when you use an abrasive formulation, you would be putting something like 80 to 100,000 microbeads down the drain every time you did that.
But a new process from British researchers is using naturally biodegradable cellulose to create microbeads.
Because of the way cellulose degrades, it should degrade in the wastewater treatment plant. It shouldn't even make it into the oceans.
The microbeads are made by squeezing the cellulose through a tiny steel membrane.
With this project, we use a relatively small membrane. This is about 1 centimeter in diameter, roughly 10 centimeters of active area. And this membrane itself contains millions of pores, meaning we're making millions of droplets, millions of microbeads.
That's a lot of microbeads, but not nearly enough to meet the demand. So the team is trying to gear up production.
But this is too small for an industrial scale process. And there are two ways to make more beads. One, you use a bigger membrane. So this is double the length. So you're making double the amount of product. And you can also have more than one membrane, and so that's called numbering up. So you have the more membranes you have, the more product you have.
The researchers have teamed up with a British firm called Micropore Technologies to take production to an industrial scale and to expand the range of products. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We're proud to say that you can get our program in many different ways besides the voanews.com website. Try iTunes and SoundCloud if you'd like to download us as a podcast and take VOA Asia wherever you go. We'd also like to hear from you. Visit VOA Asia Facebook and send us a message, whatever's on your mind. We've got email too, voaasia@voanews.com. We also have a director, Tracy Carter, and an engineer, Jim Harmon. We thank them both for their efforts today. Managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day.